Hello, and welcome to Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson, editor at Offbeat Magazine.
Support for WHIV comes from Offbeat Magazine at offbeat.com.
Celebrating Mardi Gras with our February issue that features the Monogram Hunters Mardi Gras Indians, interviews with Alinda Segarra, Corey Ledet, recipes from musicians for carnival season, reviews, and much more. Access Offbeat content, our improved music listings calendar, original videos, and photos with your subscription at offbeat.com and on social media at Offbeat Magazine. I want to wish all of our listeners a very happy Mardi Gras. We're now in the thick of the season. In just a few days, we will reach Fat Tuesday, and as we know, millions of beads will be dispensed from hundreds of floats from the lavish crew parades that will wind their way down St. Charles Avenue and Canal Street. But further away from the larger scene of the parades are traditions in the Afro-Creole community that have been practiced here for centuries, and today we'll be discussing those. My first guest will be Bruce Sunpie Barnes and his son Aurelian Barnes, who are part of the Northside Skull and Bone Gang, the practice of masking skeleton that goes back to 1819. And in the second half of our program, I will welcome Kim Vaz DeVille, a professor at Xavier University, who's done an extensive study on how the COVID-19 pandemic has affected the masking traditions within the African-American community in New Orleans.
Bruce and Aurelian.
Good morning, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Aurelian Barnes is a Grammy-nominated trumpeter and singer, formerly of the band Chawa, who has most recently become a founding member of a new band, The Rumble, who perform Wednesday nights at the Maple Leaf. He's a member of the Northside Skull and Bone Gang, along with his father, Bruce. Bruce Sunpie Barnes is a veteran musician and actor, a former park ranger, and a former NFL player for the Kansas City Chiefs. He's a multi-instrumentalist playing piano, percussion, harmonica, and he learned to play accordion from some of the best in Louisiana, including Fernest Arsenault, John Delafosse, and Clayton Sampe. With his musical group, Sunpie and the Louisiana Sunspots, he's played festival and concerts all across New Orleans and the U.S., as well as internationally, and he's recorded 5 critically acclaimed CDs. Bruce is deeply involved in the New Orleans parade culture and takes his music to the streets. He is the big chief of the Northside Skull and Bone Gang, one of the oldest existing carnival groups in New Orleans, and a member of the Black Men of Labor Social Aid and Pleasure Club. So Bruce, let's start with you. Give me a little background on the skeleton masking tradition in New Orleans. Where does this tradition come from?
Well, the tradition has been around quite a long time, and as it was told to me and has been passed along by from Big Chief to Big Chief, my Big Chief was a man named Albert Morris, Big Al. Al Morris was a masking skeleton at the age of 7 here in New Orleans, and his Big Chief was Arthur Regis, and it's, you know, going down the line, but as it's been passed along to us, the tradition started here in the Sixth Ward area of New Orleans in this section of town known as the Treme by a sailor, a merchant marine, who came into the city and started the tradition in the year 1819, masking as a skeleton. He came from some part of Africa or South America, as it's been told at that time, and it's remained in the neighborhood that it started in, and it's called the Northside Skull and Bone Gang because it was the first community that was created outside the French Quarter on the north side of the city proper at that time. So there you have it, the Northside Skull and Bone Gang, men of African descent, Afro-Creole men masking as the dead, waking up the city, bringing messages of nonviolence, bringing messages of for people to remember what carnival is. And of course, this tradition started at a time during enslavement when you only had one day like that to be able to express who you were and to be able to actually be in the streets of the city in some form or fashion that was not strictly regulated. And, you know, so we remember those traditions. We call on our family spirits, you know, sing in the cemetery, entertain the spirits, and ask them to come with us, to take a walk with us and embody us and wake the city up again on Mardi Gras morning in the pre-dawn.
Bruce, how long have you been engaged in this tradition?
I started masking in 1999 by invitation from Al. He rode up to me on a bicycle one day. I was getting ready to try and open a fairly new national park in a location down in the French Quarter in Dutch Alley. And I knew him from hanging out in the neighborhood. We used to all hang out over on the porch of what was the Backstreet Cultural Museum up to this time, but it hadn't opened at the time. But, you know, I knew him and a bunch of the Indian chiefs at that time. Some of my, one of my best friends was Donald Harrison Sr. So we'd hang out there at that place. It was just kind of a meeting place. But Al was masking skeleton at that time. And, you know, he asked me to, if I ever thought about masking. I said, no, indeed, man. Why would I think? Well, I think of something like that. He said, well, you ought to think about it. You want to? And I said, okay, I'll think about it. So I gave it a little bit of thought, but not a whole lot. And then I seen him again. I was still over there in Dutch Alley there, starting one of our first programs. He came back by and said, well, what did you think? You didn't give me an answer. And so I paused for a minute and I said, well, you know what? I think I will try this. And so that's really how I began working with him. And he had me come out with him on that Super Sunday downtown that year. So, you know, it was exciting. I didn't know what I was doing. Definitely didn't get a whole lot of instruction initially. I was intrigued enough to, since he was the only one coming out masking by himself at the time, to, you know, it was like that old Dracula bite, getting bitten by Dracula. And that was it for me. And I had a lot of friends that had asked me to mask skeleton, like Donald. You know, he was trying to teach me how to sew, but I was a little too hard-headed. And I was also trying to play accordion, you know. But I would support him, and I liked hanging out with a lot of the older masking Indians, like the man that was the chief of chiefs at the time, Robert Lee. And because they would tell a lot of stories, you know, to me about what the masking culture was about, with the White Eagles and how they began, and the Creole Wild West. And Donald had masked with both of those gangs. A lot of the old songs in Creole that the Indians would sing, and, you know, he was often, you know, he had his thoughts and complaints about younger Indians not really understanding what lyrics meant and things like that. So it was education, a free education, the kind I couldn't get in the university, but I felt was really important. You know, just being a park ranger and being a citizen in the city. And so when I started masking with Al, I knew that that was something that I fell in love with it. I wanted to keep the tradition alive and have it grow and be able to become something that sustained itself in the city, because not that many people outside of some neighborhoods knew anything about skeletons masking. So, you know, Skull and Bone Gang, it's a thing that I've been endeared to.
Yes, very good. Now, Aurelian, I know you have joined your father for these early morning rituals with the Skeleton Gang. Describe to him what that was like, especially as a kid, being part of this tradition.
Growing up, I kind of was more of just like an observer. I didn't actually mask until last Mardi Gras before COVID. It was always something that was really intriguing to me, and obviously it didn't really have the same kind of community like awareness that like the masking Indians had, for example. It was kind of something that I didn't really quite have as much context to understand. So I was kind of observing. But as I got older, I started to kind of discover within myself like a desire to be a part of the tradition, because I'm hanging around guys in the band, hanging around a lot of Indians and stuff like that, and just watching, like kind of like the same way my dad just said, like hanging around them and hearing a lot of the old stories and kind of wanting to be a part of that. But then also understanding that there's this tradition in the Skull and Bone Gang that even dates even before that. And so there's a long legacy that I can be a part of. And so that's kind of like what intrigued me to start getting more interested and start paying attention a little more to what was going on with the Skull and Bone Gang. And then one year I decided I was like, I want to be a part of this. I want to learn about this. I want to sit down. I want to make the whole suit. I want to sit down and make the head and every component about it and learn as much as I can. So that I can one day be a part of this and carry this tradition on, because that's part of what drives me, is being a part of the legacy and learning as much as I can so that I can continue the oral tradition. That's the only way that we know anything about ourselves as Black people, is the oral tradition, because everything else has been taken away from us or never even existed in the first place. So we just pass culture down like that, and that's a connection I can feel to my ancestors. And ironically enough, we dressed as skeletons.
But tell me, when you put on this headpiece, this large papier-mâché skull, and you put on the skeleton outfit, what does that feel like? What kind of sensation comes over you?
It definitely feels like I'm a part of something that, like a long line of, I'm one of many ancestors that have been a part of something like this, whether it was in this exact way or in a different way, because this kind of culture exists in West Africa, this kind of relationship with the dead. And so I know that I'm a part of something special. And also, I'm just very proud.
So, Bruce, I know the skeletons are conveying a message throughout there. Tell me what that is. What are you telling everyone as you wake everybody up in those very early morning hours of Mardi Gras morning?
Well, you know, David, I go into it in a deep kind of way that is not for everybody in the gang. First of all, I invite my own ancestral spirits to come with me. And, you know, they ride you. It can be heavy some days. It can be light on another day. But I don't really try and do anything but be an open vessel for what's going to happen. We don't have a set route. The tradition is invite the ancestral spirits and have them do the talking and make the movement and the whole thing. That's what we do. But messages that come from us, first of all, we are like the, in a visual sense, we are the literal meaning of what carnival is all about, the shedding of the flesh. And Mardi Gras Day is the day, of course, that it comes to a culmination. So yeah, we remind people about their own mortality. It's kind of like looking into a mirror. That's how people react when they see the Skull and Bone Gang coming down the street. Some people are going to run towards you, happy and elated. Others are going to slam their door and go inside and lock the door, pull the shutters down. And it's like a mirror being thrown up in front of you. Of course, our neighborhoods have changed a lot, so a lot of people don't really understand and know those traditions. But, you know, we sing songs that bring direct messages like Too Late, Your Mama Can't Help You. And, you know, a lot of these songs have come to me, you know, in dreams, almost all of them. Our Northside Skull and Bone song that we sing, the song Too Late, Ashes to Ashes, different things. That's as much a part of the tradition as letting those things happen and come through you. You know, we knock on doors, sometimes we go in people's houses, you name it, I've done it all. I don't really set up or preconceive anything. Sometimes people say, you coming by my house? Yeah, we don't be ready for you. We got this, we got that, we got food, we're gonna have champagne, we're gonna have. I don't know if I'm coming by your house, but you know, because I'm not even in that head sense at all. You can see very little when you have that head on. But it's the real deal. Really, the cheapest thing on the street, we came from the working man to make those heads. And I've kind of modified a few little things there. But the horns, I've been to Africa, you know, a handful of times. And, you know, being able to, you know, get those antlers from antelopes and different animals. Because that's a part of the thing, the visual and the spiritual connection with the motherland, so to speak. But yeah, we make our suits out of, you know, sweats, long johns is a tradition, paint, flour, baling water, like wire, like you bale hay or cotton with, and some paint. Cheapest thing on the street with the maximum effect, because it's like what you put into the suit is what really makes it work, is the deal. You know, that's part of our tradition, masking the skeletons of the Skull and Bone Gang, you know.
These are men who appear every Mardi Gras morning dressed as skeletons, and they roam the neighborhoods, waking everybody up at the pre-dawn hour. So, Bruce, tell me, you said you had been to Africa. You have seen other variations, I'm sure, of this tradition. Can you give me examples of what you have witnessed?
Northern Ghana, but they have some tradition there. But really along the coast, the Sacred Forest of Bay, which is in Togo, where the Ewe people come from. A lot of our ancestral genealogy is from right along that coast, as well as the Congo. But yeah, in those spaces, ancestor rituals and worship is where it's at. It's the Ewe, the Ga people. Yoruba, if you go a little farther over, but definitely the Ewe tradition there is one of the strongest cultures of what, you know, came to the U.S. and to the southern U.S. here because of the people that were brought here from that coast there. that coastline, but in Ivory Coast also, almost everywhere you see masking. Every village has a shrine and spirit mass that bring the ancestors back to the village in a physical form, as well as what you have with an altar or a shrine. So it's everywhere. It's all the rural villages, you know, in those spaces are definitely very, very strong culture there. Senufu people, the Mandinka, the, you know, Tuba.
And these represent any number of different spirits or any number of different roles. Like they're not just, you know, there's a lot of variation. So what we do is kind of like one facet of.
Well, yeah, we're African Americans, so we
Right.
take them all on. So
Exactly. Yeah,
as we
we
had
kind of
to.
take everything that we
Yeah.
can get.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Aurelian, another way I know you're carrying forward tradition, but also being very innovative, is with your new band, The Rumble. Tell me about the band. How did you come up with the name, especially?
Yeah, well, the name of the band kind of emerges out of the sound that you hear on the streets, you know, that accompanies either, you know, it's any part of our black culture here. Like it can be a second line, or it can be the drums and the singing and the tambourines that accompany the masking Indians when they come out, or the drums and the singing and the sound that accompanies the Skull and Bone Gang when we come out. So basically, the rumble is just that. It's that ambiance that surrounds the music and the culture of our city. So we're fronted by Second Chief Joseph Boudreaux Jr., the Golden Eagles Black Masking Indian Tribe. So he's, you know, he represents that culture. I represent the Skull and Bone Gang. We got the brass band culture is represented mainly by Jose Mays on trombone. He plays with the TBC Brass Band. You can see him at almost, you know, any second line centered event in New Orleans, you'll see him over there. And you know, we got a great rhythm section with some of the funkiest guys in town, Ari Title and Andrew Yanofsky and TJ Norris. So we've also got Trent O'Neill playing with us, very, very multifaceted players. So we kind of can encompass all of New Orleans, and that's the goal.
I know we can catch that band every Wednesday night at the Maple Leaf.
Yeah, and every Wednesday in February, yep. And then Mardi Gras Day also.
At the Maple Leaf?
Yeah, at the Maple Leaf at night. Yep.
You'll have a very long day, starting with the
Oh
skeleton.
yeah, it's gonna be a long one.
Welcome to the club.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But Bruce, let's talk a bit about your music career. You're very well known, of course, for playing the accordion. I'm curious to know how you got started with that.
Well, yeah, you know, I was a harmonica player for years, and you know, played trombone when I was a, you know, young fella, you know, in marching bands. But I came out of blues tradition a lot, you know, blues and you know, spiritual gospel music, which my family was, you know, just playing around the house. But the accordion started for me here in New Orleans. I was playing rubboard and harmonica with friends of mine and in a band with Furnace Arsenault and the Thunders. And the drummer, really, Jockey Etienne, who's pretty famous for having recorded hundreds of records for Accello Records, you know, with Lazy Lester. They were proteges in the same age, basically. Having recorded a lot of records with them and then moved on, you know, playing with Lil Bob and the Lollipops, with Solomon Burke, you name it. So he was like one of the pioneer drummers in the zydeco music. So I played, you know, played rubboard and harmonica and enjoyed it. And then, you know, I had a series of dreams that I was playing accordion one week. Yeah, I dreamed, had the same dream like 4 or 5 nights in a row, and walked into a Wurlines on Canal Street to buy some harmonicas, and the accordion that was in my dream was hanging on the wall. So I ended up walking out the door with that thing. Didn't know what I was going to do with it, or really even how to pay for it at the time, because it was like one of the first things I ever financed in my life. I'd always bought everything cash, and I but I only had $200 on me, and at the moment, and I, you know, end up getting this accordion. It costs $1,450.
Wow.
Took it home, tried to sit down and figure out what all the buttons were going on and the keys. And a friend of mine, Lou Bordelon, called me, asked me to come and do a commercial or audition for one, for a Sprite commercial. And I was, you know, had speakerphone on. So I'm sitting there talking to him. I was like, yeah. And I had an accordion. I was making noise. He said, man, what is that racket you got going on? I said, man, I bought an accordion. And can you believe it? He said, oh, bring it. And I said, I don't know how to play it. So I stayed up all night trying to figure out how to make up a tune. Went to the audition the next day. I actually called in sick because I stayed up all night, called in sick to work. Went to the audition, played my little harmonica piece. I had the accordion in the case behind me because, you know, I brought it, but I didn't want to pull it out because I didn't know how to play. And I played about 30 seconds, you know, and these people, it was like 700 people in the audition. So the guy stopped me. He was like, oh, thank you very much. All right. See you later. And when I turned to leave and walk out, you know, I tripped over the case. And he said, what is that? And I said, oh, it's an accordion. He said, well, let's hear it. So I was scared to death to pull it out and fumble through my little tune I'd made. And I got the part. So it was a national commercial. Bingo. You know, the next day I had to call in sick to work again because I got the part in the film. And did the commercial. Went back down to World Lines, paid for my accordion that I had financed for 24 months. And that's how I started playing. And I got lucky and got another commercial the same week. That was a Tuesday. I did a commercial on Wednesday. Went back for another audition Thursday and got a part in a McDonald's commercial for Friday. And that's how I began playing. And then I went to Clayton Sampe afterwards to try and get some lessons. I got about 4 lessons from him. On accordion down in Karen Crow, you know, and that's it.
Obviously, it was meant to be, especially if you're on national television before getting lessons from the masters.
Playing the accordion upside down, too.
Well, I'm left-handed, so I didn't know I was playing, you know, upside down and backwards until I sat down in front of Clayton. And he looked at me and he shook his head. He said, I can't show you nothing. I said, what? He said, man, I can't show you nothing. And I said, well, what? You know, and I'm like, it took me 4.5 hours to find him. And he said, I can't show you nothing. I said, what's, is there a problem? He said, yeah, you got it on upside down. And it's backwards. So
that's the number one.
Yes. You can't play. Yeah, I mean, you could play left-handed, but you couldn't play left-handed in front of him. So I had to learn how to play right-handed. I had to go home, and it took me about 6 months before I showed back up at his door again, but I had to get in front of a mirror so I could, I turned it over, and then in the mirror, everything is reversed still. And kind of, that's the left-handed world, though. That's the kind of stuff you have to do if you're left-handed all the time. Is,
of course.
Yeah, there's no forgiveness for being left-handed.
So tell us, where can we find the Skull and Bone Gang on Mardi Gras morning?
Mardi Gras morning, we are coming out at a new location. I'm very excited. It's right in the neighborhood there, Little People's Place Bar at 1226 Barrack Street. We're coming out pre-dawn, 5:30 in the morning. We will roll out. So if folks want to catch us in that early morning, I would suggest 5 o'clock is a good time to be there. But it's this old bar with lots of brass bands like the Rascals and, you know, Treme All-Stars, all kinds of bands played in the Little People's Place, and it is the smallest bar that's left around in that neighborhood. It's like a lot of little saloons and bars that used to be, but it's the real deal, authentic. So that is the new space for the Northside Skull and Bone Gang, and we will roll out of there, 1226 Barracks.
How do you feel about having a large crowd gathered to witness this? Does it in any way detract from the experience, or does it add to it?
It's all good. I'm going to do the same thing if there's one person out there or none. You know, we come out, we wake up the city, and I've done both for years. You know, when we came out, it was kind of nice in some ways to be able to like hit the street and because it was totally unexpected at that time. You know, and then people start to see you. But over the years, I've learned that yeah, it's good to have a good healthy crowd, and the crowds have grown. If you've been there in the last 7, 8, 9, or 10 years, you've seen that, well over 1,000 people, upwards of 2,000 sometimes that we would have. And after you do all that work and you wrestle with it and tussle with it and lose sleep and everything like that, it's good to have people to actually know some of these things that have been, more of a definitely a secret society. They don't know everything about what we do, but they know something, and they get to, we bring blessings to people as well. So they get to witness some really old New Orleans tradition that you can't get anywhere else. Similar to other things that they may have seen or they know about, but we are our own thing. It didn't come from anywhere but New Orleans, and you're getting a real authentic part of New Orleans.
Indeed. Aurelian, wanted to ask you, was it difficult to make your first skeleton suit? I mean, obviously you learned from your father, but tell me about what it was like to make that.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult not ever having done it before. The first one looked a little funny, but we've improved, so it was cool to learn all the steps of how to do it. Now I can pretty much do it, so.
And you play the
Hey.
trumpet. I'm curious to know where you started the trumpet at.
The trumpet I started kind of, I had a trumpet a little bit before Katrina that I was, noodling around with that my dad got me, and I was just, after Katrina, went out and we evacuated to Lafayette, and they had a little band over there. I started playing a little bit, and then when we got back to town, my dad started this music for all ages program over at the National Park Service, and that's how I kind of got started really playing, learning from some of the traditional brass bands here in New Orleans, like the Tremé Brass Band, with Uncle Lionel and Uncle Benny and all those guys. And so, yeah, those were my first teachers. That's how I got started playing, and then from then on, just kind of in school, and then started playing with brass bands, and eventually branched my way out into doing all the different projects that I'm doing now.
Bruce, you've been a part of a short documentary that documented the masking skeleton. Tell us about that before we close out.
Oh yeah, this is a project that I did with some grad students from Columbia University several years ago. In 2017, we started working on that. It's a short doc. It's called Skull and Bone. They initially just wanted to like film us coming out on Mardi Gras Day as part of their one of their final assignments, for their thesis. It was a group of four people, but I said if you really want to do it right, we'll co-produce this thing, and I can narrate parts of it and actually explain what we do. And two of the people were like, "Yes, let's do that," and the other two were like, "I don't think so." And so we did come together. We talked about it, made sense out of it, and they were great film students and producers, music, audio, videography, you name it. So it's been in about eight different film festivals. Started out at Tribeca, went to Chicago Film Fest, Palm Springs, Traverse City, Bogota, and Colombia. A year and a half in the Cannes Library, Cannes Film Festival in France, and around different places. And then New Orleans Tourism and Marketing picked up the film 2019 as a campaign for people to take back a real New Orleans experience as opposed to a souvenir. So, and that's rolling out again this year also. Nice short doc, and it's it's educational in the context of how it works as well. So.
Very good. And we'll have that doc posted to offbeat.com as well. As we close out, we're going to listen to an audio clip from that documentary. But I want to wish both Aurelian and Bruce a very happy Mardi Gras and look forward to seeing you. I plan to be up in the pre-dawn hour myself to witness
Great,
this.
David. I'll call you. Don't worry. Happy to wake you up. I'll set your alarm for you.
Very good. Yes, indeed. I'll certainly be awake by the time you start your chanting out there, no doubt. Thank you both again, and we'll be back in the second half of our program with Dr. Kim Vaz DeVille of Xavier University, who will be discussing the baby doll tradition and research she has done on Black masking traditions in New Orleans. Thank you again, Bruce and Aurelian.
Thank you.
WHIV 102.3 FM, your headquarters for human rights and social justice. 102.3 WHIV FM.
Historically, not everyone could
participate in the parading tradition, because many different tiers in society that says that if you're considered, for example, a second-class citizen, no, you could not participate in the official parade.
The Northside Skull and Bone Gang comes out dressed as skeletons, as the dead. I would say it's created out of the spirit of resistance. The type of existence that Africans were subjected to in this country. This is what carnival became. It was a way to survive. A way to pass messages on to the next generation that you can survive it as hard as it is. And ironically, as hard as it was in 1819, it's still hard right now. Very hard for Black people in this country to live, exist, and survive in any peaceful way. And this is a city where Black people have always felt that they mattered. They've had a lot to fight against. But on Carnival Day, that day is for everybody. And it says you can be anything you want to be other than your natural self.
It's important to understand what carnival even is, the shedding of the flesh. To honor those that have gone before us. Those are long-lasting, long-standing African traditions, and when it comes to spirituality, you're not gonna make it to the other side and do anything without understanding that you're walking on the shoulders of giants. My name is Bruce Sunpai Barnes, and I'm a musician, but I'm also the chief of the Northside Skull and Bone Gang, and it's carnival time in New Orleans. We are under the veil of the Mardi Gras. Imanja dewa babawa, imanja dewa haribo,
sababu. WHIV 102.3 FM.
And welcome back to Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson, editor at Offbeat Magazine. And today we're discussing Mardi Gras traditions in New Orleans, as we're just days away now from Fat Tuesday and the deep end of carnival season. And I am thrilled to have with me Kim Vaz DeVille, who is a professor of education and the associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Xavier University of Louisiana. She's the author of The Baby Dolls, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition. Her book served as the basis for a major installation on the baby doll tradition at the Louisiana State Museum as part of the museum's permanent display on the history of carnival in Louisiana. And she's also contributed to another exhibition that just closed recently, Mystery in Motion. And of course, resources from that exhibition are still available online. But I want to welcome Kim, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's so good to be here and to celebrate Mardi Gras with you and Mardi Gras history and traditions.
I'd like to start off by just asking, how did you get interested in studying the Black masking traditions here in New Orleans associated with carnival?
Well, I have always loved our traditions, and I have always loved sewing. The idea that one could create something for display and performance and excitement has always been with me since a child, and I've always loved the Indians, and I didn't know much about them. But as I began to think about where people, African Americans, were creating different kinds of knowledge, what I would call counter-hegemonic knowledge, knowledge that empowers African Americans and passes on their own traditions, I began to reflect on the role of these masking traditions as sites of public pedagogy, where lessons were being learned, skills were being transferred, people were creating living museums using the street as the stage. And I wanted to capture that. And I especially started with the women. I wanted to capture what had Black women done, you know, to assert their presence at a time when they were certainly not welcome in the white community during segregation? That's really the origin of my interest in this topic.
So tell me about Mystery in Motion, the exhibition at the Louisiana State Museum. How did that come to be?
I took an exploratory trip with faculty and staff from Xavier University of Louisiana, where I'm a professor. And we went to Cuba because we wanted to see and evaluate the research sites that our students would work in. And I went to Casa de Africa, which is a museum in Havana, and they were celebrating the Orishas, which is the Yoruba religion. And that religion is so important to the people there, and it survived the Middle Passage. And when I was talking to some of the Afro-Cuban security guards, I showed them where I was from. We were exchanging information about where we were from. I showed them some of the Black masking Indians, and they thought that those were tributes to the Orishas, to the gods. And I thought that was just so interesting. And sort of had this view as I was walking down the street of Havana of the different Indians and the different colors. Maroon would be for the goddess Oya, the goddess of change. Green would be for Ogun, or Ishosi for the wilderness, the medicines available. Red would be for Shango. Blue would be for, Shango is the god of thunder and lightning and justice. And I just imagine them sort of walking ahead as these big or larger than life spirits. And it began to dawn on me that our masking traditions are larger than life. They are about us, but beyond us. And I wanted to capture that, not just for the Yoruba influences in African Americans in New Orleans who are creating masks for Mardi Gras, but also other traditions that I began to see. I began to see Rastafarian traditions embedded in suits. I began to see Ankhs from the Egyptian religion incorporated many times into suits from many different tribes. There was, and of course, there's the overlay of Catholicism and Catholic ritual calendar on top of all of these different traditions. And there's even Islam that makes its appearance in suits. There's the skull and bones tradition, which comes from Haiti and our Haitian influence. The Loa Gede of the cemetery, sometimes we think of them as Baron Samdi. There were all of these traditions. And of course, voodoo, you know, we have to think about New Orleans voodoo, and that's being expressed during Mardi Gras and the other ritual times aligning with the Catholic ritual calendar where Black people are coming out and masking. And so this is not just for show, but this is a reflection. The people in the show live the spiritual lives that they represent in their masking traditions. For example, like Fayaya and that tribe, extremely spiritual. Their whole tribe is organized around spirituality. And, you know, they have a wild man, and they have a medicine woman. They have the drumming, you know, and in Africa, that each drum represented a different god. So they have it's like the voices of the gods. And the big chief, Victor Harris, says that he can no longer see himself masking without the percussion accompaniment. You know, you need that voice of the spirit to put you into chants. The chanting that's done is not complex. So the chanting is there to induce one to go into a ritual space, a ritual, a feeling of possession. And so many of the maskers feel that they are possessed by a different spirit, by something other than who they normally are. You know, when they're in these beautifully handmade garments that are just so ripe with symbolism. And that was the reason that I wanted to have the exhibit, because Mardi Gras Day is fast, and Mardi Gras Day can't be covered by one person. And you'll never know all of the symbolism in a particular costume or suit unless you have the ability to talk to the person and study it. And Mystery in Motion gives that opportunity for people to examine the creations and understand the underlying concepts and also the construction of the suits. And so that was, you know, the motivation to allow people to come and have what Catholics call visio divina, which is the opportunity to look at an image and look for the divinity in that image, to reflect, to repose, to think about what your challenges are in life and what those images can help you, what solutions they can come up with in reflecting on the different themes that are in these creations. So that is also the purpose of the exhibit. So we had so many spiritualities represented. There was one person in 2020 who made a suit with the Sankofa symbols, which are Ghanaian symbols. The bird looks back and the feet are pointed forward or vice versa. But it's the idea that you look back to bring forward. And so people are reaching back to their African traditions and African heritage to bring something forward into the present, to live their lives better, stronger. And in the middle of that particular suit, which was had the number of birds, Sankofa birds is the number of children that the masker had, was a portrait, a beaded portrait of the eternal leader of the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad. Now, you would never know that unless you understood all of that symbolism. But so many people, there's not a class for that kind of symbolism, you know, for the masses. So, you know, people are seeing this and they're taking it in. And I wanted to have a place where people could come and understand the multidimensionality, the many conversations that are happening on Mardi Gras Day for Black maskers.
That's great. You know, it's so true that when you're out seeing the Indians in the street, as we know, it's all in motion. You know, they are doing their rituals, they're dancing, they're playing instruments, and there really isn't that you say, that moment to pause and really look and study and you know, get a greater understanding of the detail work in these suits. Now, I know from the exhibition, you have spun off another project that you're working on currently called the Good Life Project. And that is through Morgan State University in Baltimore with funding from the Henry Luce Foundation, where you have been looking particularly at how COVID-19 and the pandemic has affected the Black masking tradition in New Orleans. Could you give me a little background on this project and what you've discovered?
Yes. This project is from Morgan State University's Center for the Study of Religion and the City. It's 8 different investigators exploring different ways that COVID has impacted people of color and mounting a response to that. Sometimes it's making sure that vulnerable people have healthy food to eat. So there is a, you know, like an urban farming component. Someone else is looking at the role of pet and how important pets have become in the lives of people during the quarantine. In my case, I wanted to see how COVID impacted some of the Black maskers who had exhibited work in Mystery in Motion, but who had mounted public displays of a response to COVID. And so we know that people of color had been disproportionately affected by COVID because of their role as frontline and essential workers, and because many are living in multi-generational households. They had jobs in which they could not quarantine themselves, or they had certain illnesses which predisposed them to compromised immune systems. So within the community of maskers, they were hit particularly hard. And so I wanted to do oral histories on a series of Black maskers, such as Charisse Harrison Nelson, who is the queen of the Maroons. And she calls herself not masking, but unmasking, being who she truly is, a person with a descent from a Maroon community that self-emancipated and tried to live on their own outside of a system of slavery. And what she did was to put on the plague mask, and she became the plague doctor. And she calls herself a cognitive provocateur. And she would stand at intersections with signs about Breonna Taylor to symbolize that not only was COVID an epidemic, but so was structural racism, especially as we're seeing it in police murders of African Americans. And so she said she made about 50 plague doctor appearances, and sometimes there would be very strong reaction to it. You know, some people really opposed the idea, but she persisted nonetheless. And then there was the response, the very public response by the big chief of the Young Seminole Hunters, Damon Melanson, who has a trio of suits that have been dedicated to Haile Selassie and the Rastafaris and the Nyabingi warriors, using complex iconography from the Ethiopian Coptic church and putting it into his suits. You know, the last suit that he made in 2020, he was not able to wear it, and he couldn't believe that he had spent all that time, because he has given up his job in order to make his masks, because they're so complex and they're so large and they're so beautifully rendered that he felt that he just couldn't keep getting fired from a job every time Mardi Gras came around because he had to work on his suit. And so now he does that full time. But he went to where the Jefferson Davis statue had been, and he had permission from the city and encouragement from the city on Mardi Gras Day, and placed his suit in a clear case where people could see, imagine what could be on that statue besides the Confederate legacy of the South, and what kind of empowering images can replace that. He wasn't saying necessarily that he should be there, but that we have many people who have contributed to our democracy that should be there. And some of them are African Americans. And he wanted to make that particular statement. And he also beaded a portrait of a man and a woman with masks on, saying, "We won't bow down." Meaning, you know, we're not going to bow down to COVID. And using the language and ideas from the Black masking tradition, because they say we won't bow down. They won't bow down to anyone, because their idea is to be as free and emancipated as possible, even though the structure of our system still, you know, keeps African Americans in New Orleans in a pretty low wage, low asset position. You know, there still is a resistance to being defined in certain ways and confined in certain ways. And so they use their Mardi Gras regalia to give that reminder. Another important person in this was Carol Harris, Baby Doll Kit. She has founded the New Orleans Dollins Baby Dolls, and they are as fun as Baby Dolls are. Baby Dolls are a masking group which started around the same time that the Zulu Social Aid and Pleasure Club started, in the same neighborhood. And they were groups of women who would come out in short skirts and sing body songs and have a great time on Mardi Gras Day at a time when going into the public streets was dangerous for women. Because the streets all the way up, maybe to the 60s and 70s, was defined as a public space, and men were on a public space, and women should be in the domestic sphere. Or if they're in the public space, they should be accompanied by a man. But the baby dolls were accompanied by each other, other women, and also men who were out there masking with them and protecting them. There's nothing in the lore, the folklore, in which a baby doll was ever molested or her money taken from her, which I consider very interesting, because they would carry bricks and they would carry whips and they would carry ice picks, because, you know, the idea was if you're on the public street as a woman, you're a public woman, and they were not going to allow themselves to be taken advantage of, and they weren't. And so that tradition, of course, died down, and now it's resurrected and it's flourishing and people are defining it in new ways. But Kit's family was hit particularly hard during the pandemic. Both her mother and her mother's sister, who took care of her mother, both died, and they had a funeral for both of them. And they couldn't hold, as an Afro-Creole family, their second line jazz funeral. And of course, we know that the funerals, Black funerals with music, predates the creation of jazz. It's something that had always been in the community. But we call them jazz, but that symbolism of music with the burying the dead, you know, comes from their African traditions and encounters with Native Americans. So they weren't able to really do that. So they had a few baby dolls who came out and put masks on, you know, to accompany the hearses to where they were going. There's been a lot of responses. People have been encouraging each other to get vaccinated. So the masking traditions are using their own networks to help people stay safe and to get resources to people because they've been hit hard, particularly because they depend on jobs, entertainment jobs, tourist attractions for, you know, for their livelihood.
Right. And we saw, of course, that so severely impacted throughout the pandemic. We're going to take a brief break and we'll be back with Kim Bosville in just a moment.
For human rights and social justice, WHIV 102.3 FM.
And welcome back to Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson talking with Kim Bosville about Black carnival traditions here in New Orleans. And we had been talking about the exhibition Mystery in Motion, which was on view at the Louisiana State Museum. It has since closed, but there are many online resources that you can look up to learn more about the exhibition. And that is very simply found at mysteryinmotion.info. Now, Kim, I know that the exhibition is going to go on tour. Where will it be next?
Yes. From the inception of the exhibit, we were working with Stephen Bourget, who is the director of the Americas Collection at the Kay Bronley Museum in Paris. Portions of the exhibit from Mystery in Motion, African American Masking and Spirituality in Mardi Gras, will be on display along with a very large exposition of where Black masking traditions came from, with a particular focus on Black masking Indians. It'll be about a 6,000 square foot exhibit, starting with the American conquest and taking the European visitors who come to see it on a historical journey of African American enslavement, Reconstruction, the life under Jim Crow, the resistance, and how these traditions have changed over time, how they compare with white traditions such as Rex, you know, how they were impacted for the Hurricane Katrina tragedy, how they have come back, because there are probably more Indian tribes today than there have ever been in the early years of Black masking, actually. And so this is a tradition that is not about to go anywhere anytime soon because there are so many young people in it. So that exhibition is going to open in October 4th, 2022, and it'll run through about January 15th, 2023. Again, in Paris, and they are very excited. There will be a major catalog to accompany that exhibit. If people are in Paris or if they have friends in Paris, please encourage them to go to the opening and the panels and plenaries and programming that, you know, that will be planned and made available to, you know, to those who come to see the exhibit.
That's great news. You know, it takes a tremendous amount of effort, obviously, to create these suits, the Mardi Gras Indian suits and all of the other material items that are related to Black carnival traditions. How did COVID impact that? I mean, people were at home more, of course, but, you know, and like you said, there's a lot more young interest in this tradition now as well. Tell me a little bit more about, again, these efforts to get these lavish creations out on the streets.
Right. Well, you know, COVID created a shortage of gold beads, which are usually used to trim, you know, so there was that shortage. And could vendors get the feathers in that people typically use? Most people sat out COVID, Mardi Gras 21, which gave them more time to sew, more time to, you know, to get their suits together. Of course, it became much harder because they had less money. And because Black Mardi Gras maskers spend a disproportionate amount of their income, they don't have a lot of disposable income. So some of that money that they get, they're so devoted to this practice that they make those sacrifices. You know, it's hard to mask because not only is it hard to get the things that, you know, go into your mask, but it's also hard because you don't have the income. But on a regular, you know, Mardi Gras year, you know, people will be sewing every night. They'll get other people to help them sew because the standards of what you can look like on the street have so increased. You know, the suits used to be so much lighter because the whole idea was to play and run through the streets and find people. So you weren't going to be running with a 120-pound suit on. But today the focus has shifted onto artistry. And so what you have now are people who are extraordinarily creative. They are artists. We can't call this craft because these take a lot of complex geometry to make sure, you know, all the pieces can fit together well. It takes a lot of commitment. It's mind-boggling to sew so much because sometimes you think, like, what am I doing? And then your fingers, you know, people talk about, I know Big Chief Victor Harris always talks about the blood. When he pierces his finger, the blood gets on the thread and that goes into the suit. And so you actually have, you know, your blood suit because you're not going to stop. If you're bleeding and you have a deadline, you're going to get out there. You know, you have to hold it together like any kind of event that people are organizing. People get tense, tempers can flare, and you know, so you have to try to get along with other people, you know, while you're feeling very stressed. And people manage to do that year in and year out. It's quite a feat to get out there. It's not easy.
A labor of love and, as you say, blood, sweat, and tears as well. Yeah. So Kim, as we wrap up, I want to know, what are your plans for Mardi Gras this year?
Yes. Well, I belong to a tribe. I belong to the Golden Feather Hunters, which is Shaka Zulu's tribe. Shaka was with the Yellow Pocahontas for over 18 years, developed his own style. Three-dimensional style of masking is recognized and well respected by all the maskers and, you know, art collectors. And I really wanted to actually study, since I study Black Mardi Gras traditions, I wanted to know from the inside, from a participant observer perspective, what goes into making this. So I make my granddaughter a suit every year and understand the difficulty and hers. Well, she's a small person, but she's not that small, you know, and so you have to cover, you know, yourself with beads, and it, you know, it takes a lot of discipline. And so we'll be walking our traditional routes, probably with David Montana and the Ouachita Nation, walking around the Treme area and going down to the stage under the overpass and performing, because Shaka is a musician, and being with the tribe and then coming back and having a meal with the tribe.
Sounds wonderful. I'll be out on the streets as well. So I hope to see you there. It's, I guess that's Claiborne and Orleans, where you were talking about as a nexus there, a central point for Mardi Gras Indians particularly to gather. Well, Kim, I want to wish you a very happy Mardi Gras, all of our listeners as well. Our next episode will be on Ash Wednesday. So we'll be atoning, I suppose, at that point. But Kim, thank you so much for sharing
your
knowledge today, and bon voyage to Paris later this year. And we'll be eager to hear about the exhibition there as well.
Thank you.
I'm David Johnson at Beat Cafe here on WHIV 102.3 FM.